This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
Political changes have come to Washington this past week as Democrats have retaken control of the House and Republicans have strengthened their lead in the Senate. The question that seems to be on everyone's mind, what will this mean for the economy and the markets going forward? And initially, Jim, the markets rallied with strength the day after the election. Here on this Friday, we're giving back some of those gains, but the good news, we're still positive for the week, and we are back to being positive for the year. But what does this political change, what does it mean for the economy and the financial markets, and even the president's economic agenda going forward?
Well, Chris, this is one time the polls actually turned out to be accurate, given what happened in 2016. Going into Tuesday's elections, the polls predicted the Democrats would retake the House, which is what they did, and the Republicans would pick up seats in the Senate, which they also did. But here's the thing, this now changes the economic environment considerably. We now have two headwinds versus prior to the election when we just had one. Now we have to add a political headwind to the Fed's rate hikes for next year. Now you can say probably goodbye to Tax Cuts 2.0, which was on the agenda to make middle-class tax cuts permanent instead of allowing them to sunset, which they'll eventually do by 2025. No way that's going to happen next year without raising taxes somewhere else.
Well, but what about the bill getting passed, like, for example, in a lame duck session? Can't they still do that? I mean, Nancy Pelosi, she did say that she's willing to find common ground. I think I heard her mention on an infrastructure spending bill. So it seems that there's maybe some hope that perhaps we could see some further stimulus there.
You know, that's always a possibility, but I just don't believe likely as we head into the holiday season that Republicans could, let's say, manage to push through another tax cuts as Democrats are proposing tax increases. Now, as far as infrastructure spending, the debate will be actually how to pay for it, given the fact we're already heading towards trillion-dollar deficits next year. The deficit for fiscal year 2018 came in at close to three-quarters of $1 trillion, and the CBO is projecting that next year we're going to be at $1 trillion. So if they're talking about $1 trillion stimulus program, the question, not only that the Democrats are going to be asking, but, you know, Wall Street will be asking too, how are you going to pay for it? So Democrats are proposing raising corporate tax rates back up to 25% versus the current tax rate of 21%. I just don't see the president and the Republicans going along for it. Now, if you take a look at this, what does this mean? We've got two headwinds that are now going to be facing the economy next year. You can now add political headwinds to monetary headwinds. So our outlook in terms of what we expect the markets to do gets a lot more volatile with each new rate hike. And now we can add political discord. Now, one thing you could see, Democrats want to reverse tax cuts for upper income Americans, which would, as I mentioned, it's not going to fly with the president or Congress. So here's a possible compromise would be a national gasoline tax to pay for spending on roads, bridges, waterways, and transportation. It's probably the last thing we want to hear as Californians because we just got a gas tax that the governor passed this year. That is something that failed as a ballot initiative to remove or repeal the gas tax. It failed in California. So, Chris, the key going forward is whether the Democrat House chooses to legislate versus investigate. At this time, we simply don't know, which is what adds another dimension of uncertainty to the markets. And it's why we expect more volatility next year. Now, if it is investigate, then we would expect to see a recession probably much sooner than what our 2020 forecast is calling for. It could come as late as the second half of next year.
Well, it'll be interesting to see if there is investigation versus legislation. There's been some talk about Jeff Sessions' replacement. So there still seems to be a little bit, at least of uncertainty, at least in that regard. But something we mentioned, Jim, on our last show is that the Fed would meet. So let's talk about that Fed meeting, which occurred this week.
Yeah, it's amazing. The Fed met this week, and given the elections, you know, it was kind of like nothing happened. Well, nothing happened. They didn't raise. But what was clear in that meeting is another rate hike is coming next month. In the words of the chairman, and I'm quoting him here, "We are a long way from neutral at this point," he said. And the other thing he said, "We need interest rates to be gradually, very gradually, moving back towards neutral." So the real key is inflation and economic growth is going to be the key to what the Fed will be doing next year. Now, if inflation heats up, as signs are pointing to, then the Fed could get more aggressive, and that's something the market's not going to like. In the words of the chairman, if we see things getting stronger and stronger and inflation moving up, then we might move a little quicker. And that's, you know, all the talk this week, Chris, was on the resignation of Jeff Sessions, the results of the election. Nobody was talking about this Fed meeting. And basically what they're saying here, we see signs of inflation, which we'll get to here shortly, are starting to pick up with either wage increases year over year at 3.1%. A lot of the manufacturers and companies have been reporting in their earnings reports that they're seeing the cost of goods go up as a result of these tariffs. So we've already seen the Fed do just that as they began the year, projecting 3 rate hikes. By the time we got to summer, as the economy picked up in the second quarter, when we got 4.2% economic growth, they changed their forecast to 4 rate hikes, which is what will happen with the final rate hike of the year coming next month. So right now, and you can see this reflected in the bond markets, 3-month Treasury bills are at 2.4%. The 2-year note is at 2.9%, and the spread between 2 and 10 years is narrowed to just about 26 basis points or a quarter of a point. So what we're seeing is the yield curve is flattening, and it looks like it could invert if the Fed keeps raising short-term rates, and that's usually a precursor to a recession. The only thing going for the economy right now next year is $460 billion of fiscal stimulus, which is tax cuts and additional government spending. But that stimulus now runs directly against political discord and rising interest rates.
Okay, but what about the impact of that stimulus? Because that's just a huge amount of money. I mean, compared to rising rates, shouldn't that be a huge impact? I mean, I ask because in investment meetings this week, the discussion was around the breakdown internally within the markets and big sectors of the economy. Shouldn't that still play a big role?
Well, we're starting to see the impact of rising rates already in, for example, if you look at the housing sector, the auto sectors, which have fallen consistently over the last several months, you can see it reflected in trends in existing home sales, new home sales, housing starts. They've all headed south. Auto sales are down from their peak. Existing home sales peaked in March along with new home sales, and new housing starts peaked in May. And as we take a look at what's happened as a result of these rising rates, mortgage rates are now approaching close to 5%. It's hard to believe. 2 years ago, you could have got a 30-year mortgage under 3.5%. But we're also seeing it reflected elsewhere. The ISM manufacturing and non-manufacturing indexes, they peaked in August and have been drifting lower. Now, I want to point out, they're still comfortably above the 50 mark, but here's the point. They're weakening. And if inflation and wages remain high and they head higher, that's going to cause the Fed to respond. And especially on the corporate earnings front next year, it's going to be a lot more difficult. I mean, all we've been talking about this year is how much corporate earnings are up double digits. Because, I mean, if you cut the tax rates from 35% down to 21%, you're going to get a whopping increase in earnings. And that's what we've seen. We've been averaging somewhere close to 25%. When we get to next year, beginning in the first quarter, year-over-year comparisons are going to be a lot tougher. And companies are reporting rising material costs, rising wages. And what does that mean? It's going to eat into profit margins. Then also, here's another factor. If you look globally, we're starting to see a slowdown in Europe, China, in most of Asia, and of course, the emerging markets. So in terms of the economy, you know, if you take a look at where we were in August and September, that's as good as it gets.
But Jim, your technicians, and really you too, you still expect the markets to head higher. So how do you suppose this plays out?
We do expect the indexes to head higher, but you know, it's what's happening within the indexes, the underlying deterioration within the indexes. And I'm just going to go through a couple examples because, you know, we've talked about the result of indexing, and what that has meant is been that you have maybe 20, 25 stocks that are carrying the index, mainly the generals. But I mean, if we take a look at some of the popular indexes, just look at the Russell 3000. 89% of the stocks are down 10% or more. 64% of the stocks are down 20% or more. 37% of the stocks are down 30% or more. 40% or more, 21%. And down over 50%, 11%. And if we break it down by various indexes, we can take a look at, for example, and this was just as the first week of December, the S&P was up 1.2%. The median stock in the index was down 3%, a spread of almost 4%. If you look at the NASDAQ, it was up 6%. The median stock in the NASDAQ was down 7%. The Russell, I just mentioned, the index is up a little over 1%. The median member is down 3.4%. If we look at the S&P, it was up as of last Friday, up 1.4%. The average stock within the index is still down 2%. Take a look at, let's say, the S&P 600, which includes more mid-cap stocks. It was up 3.5%. The index is down 6%.
Now, Jim, I know it's not just the stocks that have been going down, but also the bonds, which normally would act as a conservative hedge.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at, for example, year-to-date returns, intermediate bonds, U.S. bonds in general are down 2% for the year, and that includes the interest income. Take a look at intermediate bonds. These are bonds with, let's say, 10 years or less in maturity. They're down about 1%. If you look at corporate bonds, AAAs are down 1.5%. A-rated bonds down 3.4%. Triple B is down 3.25% for the year. And triple B is the last category of what we call investment-grade bonds. And if you look at maturities, bonds that are averaging 10 years or more in maturities are down 7.5%. Treasuries are down close to 2%. Corporates are down over 3%. So, Chris, it just hasn't been stocks in general. And this, by the way, it's global. It's global bonds are down. Global stocks are down. In fact, emerging markets got hit a lot harder than U.S. markets. So when you look at, you know, these indexes and you look at them and say, okay, the index is up 1%. That's not the average stock. You're talking about the index, which is heavily weighted towards these large cap stocks. And that's what is deceptive. We do expect the indexes to head higher into the year end. We'll get into this in just a second as to why we believe that's going to happen. But nonetheless, markets are expected to head higher, and even in the first part of the year, but they are definitely going to get a lot more volatile.
And, you know, we've heard all this week that the markets love gridlock. Even on Wednesday, we got a nice pop in all the averages after the election. Ryan Poplava at the beginning of the hour during the market wrap was mentioning that historically, the stock market's done well in years where we have a Republican president and a split Congress. So even though economic indicators are weakening, it looks like there is some positive news, and it looks like stock prices, at least from what I'm understanding from you, Jim, you believe stock prices will head higher.
Yeah, and especially now that most of, let's say, third quarter earnings season are over, and we had a listener question about this, about what are blackouts and what happens when you head into a quarterly earnings season. I forget when, it's a week before you report earnings. I'm not sure about that. But when you get ready to report earnings, you are forbidden from buying back your own stock. And the reason you do that, the SEC has put that into effect, is you basically have insider information. Imagine if you're a corporate CEO and you know your earnings are going to blow away Wall Street estimates. Well, you have inside information you can act upon and buy stocks ahead of the earnings report, and you can make a nice profit or exercise your stock options. Well, what they did is they put in a blackout period, and so you are forbidden from buying your stock prior to an earnings release, and that's called the blackout period. Well, now that third quarter earnings are over, stock buybacks are kicking in and should remain strong until the rest of the year. I mean, even guys like Warren Buffett, who loves stock buybacks, Berkshire Hathaway, bought back almost $1 billion of their own stock in the month of August. According to Goldman Sachs, they report that companies in company buybacks have jumped 51% this year and should top $940 billion by year end. So a lot of times you always hear about the Christmas rally, the Santa Claus rally. A lot of that is usually triggered by the end of the year as corporations, if they announced at, for example, the beginning of the year, they were going to buy back $2, $5, $3 billion worth of stock. If they haven't completely done their stock buybacks, usually in the month of November and December, and especially now after the correction, they usually will come into the market and buy back their stock. However, this stock buyback is heavily concentrated in just a few industries that are cash rich. Think technology, think healthcare, and financials. So even though the indexes may be heading higher, those indexes are being driven by just 25 stocks. The rest of the stocks within the indexes are in bear markets. This is what you usually see when the market is in a topping process where the generals or these big cap stocks lead the indexes higher while the troops get killed.
So Jim, stocks are heading higher, but don't you think those returns could be misleading? I mean, just given the market cap weighting, the weighting within the indexes. I mean, what we do know now is that the Fed is intent on, from what you've mentioned, and it just seems very clear that they're going to be aggressively raising rates further in trying to reach that hypothetical neutral rate, and that translates into more rate hikes. And they're now taking away the punch bowl by raising interest rates and shrinking their balance sheet.
There is no such thing as a neutral rate. I mean, if you take a look at the Fed funds rate over the last 10 years, it's averaged 38 basis points. If you look at it since the beginning of this century in the year 2000, it's averaged 171 basis points. If you look at it from the beginning of time in 1954, it averaged 480 basis points. There is no such thing as this rate, this ephemeral rate that they're talking about. I have no idea who came up with it. But the key point is, if you're running an economy which is at 38 basis points for 10 years, and you jump the rate fivefold, which is what has happened, to assume that all of the people who financed the trillions of dollars that were financed at this lower rate can automatically adjust to the higher rate without any negative consequences is, I think, a major mistake.
All right.
In addition to which, if you shrink the growth in money supply, which is roughly 6.7% since the beginning, again, of this century, to 3.8%, you know, you're doing two things. One, you're taking money away, and two, you're making the money that is available very expensive on a relative basis, and that's a very negative.
Those numbers.
So that was Mr. Beauvais on a finance interview this week talking exactly about what the Fed's doing. And so, Jim, what are the unknowns at this point, and what could either weaken or delay the onslaught of a recession at this point?
You know, one big unknown is what happens with the Democrat Congress next January. You know, the question the markets will be asking, do they come out with a conciliatory tone? In other words, do they legislate or are they going to investigate? If they proceed with impeachment, as some key members have said, or bog down the president with a series, let's say, of continuous investigations coming from all the committee chairs, that's going to be a big negative for the markets. If they instead choose to legislate, let's say, work on some compromise deal on infrastructure, such as, let's say, a national gasoline tax, that could extend this expansion until late 2019. But here's the problem. As Mr. Beauvais talked about, as the Fed drains liquidity from the financial system by shrinking its balance sheet and raising interest rates, shrinking the money supply, eventually, Chris, they're going to do what they always do, break the economy and the financial markets. Put it another way, the Fed now owns this economy because fiscal stimulus, if left untouched, is enough to keep this economy going for the next couple of years. But if they keep raising, as they indicated this week, that they are nowhere close to neutral, whatever that number or whatever that percent is, if they keep doing that, they're going to do what they always do, which is break the economy. When you take a look at their track record, 11 out of the last 12 recessions preceded by Fed rate hikes, they've only had a soft landing once in history after World War II, and that was 1994. So I just don't have a lot of confidence that they can engineer a soft landing. More likely, they crash the airplane. So, you know, enjoy this upswing, as this is good as it gets.
Given everything that's happening, it seems apparent that next year we're going to have more financial risks, greater market volatility. What do you think that looks like? I mean, maybe the more important question, what do investors do to prepare for it?
I would most definitely not be fully invested in long-term bond funds because you're losing money, as I just pointed out earlier. Every single bond index I look at, I don't care, sovereign, short-term, corporate, mortgage, they're all down. They didn't protect you in both market corrections this year, as we've been pointing out. That was one of the things that was different this year than the corrections that took place in 2010, 2011, 2015, 2016, when stocks went down and went down sharply, like, for example, the first 6 weeks of 2016. If you were in bonds, your bonds went up because interest rates fell, so they were offsetting some of the losses that you had in your stock portfolio. But they didn't work this year, and it's only going to worsen as rates head higher. If you have to be in bonds or bond funds, you would be a lot better off in a short-term bond fund so higher rates don't impact your principal as much. I prefer, let's say, short-term individual bonds, interest rate floaters where you can benefit from rising interest rates. And here's the good news, is that interest rates are rising, so you can earn 3 to 5% yields on short-term bonds, which is not a bad place to hide out.
So it's not a bad place to hide out, but what about stocks themselves?
You know, we like defensives here. If you look at what held up during the recent downturn, what is breaking out now are things like consumer staples, utilities, healthcare, and, you know, even though tech has bounced back, I also like energy as it's beaten up and the sell-off has been far too severe given the underlying fundamentals. The nice thing about getting defensive is you don't have to sacrifice yields or income. And Chris, that is something we didn't exist or have existing in 2011, 15, or 16. Back then, we were in what we call the TINA market. There is no alternative to stocks. And today, that's not the case. As the Fed continues to raise interest rates, let's say next month and next year, and if, let's say, the House chooses to investigate rather than legislate, is going to make these markets much more volatile than they have been this year. We generally tend to get a 10% correction every 2 years. We've had two 10% corrections already this year. So the volatility I'm talking about will look like this and maybe even more frequent when you start out the year. You usually see the markets rally in January. I call it the 401k rally, as individuals fund their 401k plans, their IRAs, their SEP IRAs, and pension plans. But you could easily give it all back. Just think of what happened this year. We had the markets going up every single week, setting records at the beginning of the year. And then we had that one Friday, the last week in January, and the next 6 days, the market lost 10, 12%. So next year is definitely going to be filled with more risk and volatility.
So given the fallout of the election cycle that we've just experienced with the midterms, it sounds like what you're saying, Jim, is that we can add the political uncertainty to the Fed uncertainty.
Absolutely. And it's one reason why, with more volatility, unless you're a very astute trader, you understand technicals, and you follow your markets closely, you know, you're better off getting yourself in a defensive position. You know, as the markets rally into the end of the year, you might want to take some chips off the table, take some profits. I know you're going to have to pay some taxes, but, you know, you definitely want to position yourself more on defense. As they say in football, defense wins championships. And as it gets more volatile, you're going to, you know, it's going to be hard. I mean, just like what we saw happen this year in the beginning of the year, that first second month of the year, where, you know, it looked like we were off to the races in January. And then the first week in February, we gave everything back, which really startled and surprised people. Same thing that we had if you look at what happened in September. The volatility we thought that would hit in the fall arrived a month late. But in September, the stock market, I don't care if you're looking at the Dow, the S&P, the Russell, they're all hitting new records. And then we gave it all back in 3 weeks. You're going to see more of that coming next year. So as I mentioned, as you take a look at August and September this year, whether you're looking at economic indicators or looking at what happened in the stock market, this is as good as it gets.
He wrote the article Trains, Planes, and Dot-Coms, detailing the euphoria in technology stocks and the bubble it represented 3 months before the peak in the NASDAQ. He wrote the article The Next Big Thing in April of 2002, pointing out the crossroads of a bear market fueled by monetary expansion, only to birth the next bull market in commodities. He wrote yet another prescient article in December of 2006 called The Next Rogue Wave, detailing the out-of-control credit expansion in developed economies a year before the global financial crisis began. You may know him from his weekly financial podcast, The Financial Sense News Hour. Jim Poplava has been educating the public on personal finances, investing, and the financial markets for over 30 years. He closed off his seminars to the public to focus only on his clients. Now, for the first time since the 90s, he is opening up his wealth of knowledge on the markets back to the public. Call 888-486-3939 for more information, or tune in now to his podcast, The Financial Sense News Hour, on iTunes and iHeartMedia to hear what he's saying now.
In this segment of The Big Picture, we want to cover a topic that's getting very little press at the moment, or even this year, but it really has enormous consequences. We talked about the political winds coming this year with a divided Congress, but we also want to talk about another political change that's occurring globally and now is changing here in the U.S., and that is a new Cold War developing between the U.S. and China.
Chris, this is a topic that first caught my attention in January this year when Trump negotiated a new budget deal that increased government spending. Now, part of the additional $300 billion of new spending over the next 2 years went to bolster the military, allowing it to replenish worn-out equipment and, more importantly, modernize its force structure. Now, the president signed a $1.3 trillion spending package on March 23rd of this year, and that includes an additional boost of $160 billion and defense spending over the next 2 years, reversing years of decline and unpredictable funding. I don't know if people remember under Obama, and especially when the Republicans retook Congress, there was something called the sequester, which they were basically cutting government spending to bring down the deficits. But that isn't what is significant in what was announced in January and with this new spending bill. It was a new strategy that changed, and it was announced in January of this year. In their 2018 National Defense Strategy released in January, the Defense Department announced almost a complete 180 degrees, acknowledging a period of what they call strategic atrophy. They pointed out the U.S. competitive military advantage is fast eroding, while in the meantime, global disorders are rising and great power rivalry is increasing. In their strategy review, and this is, you're going to hear more about this, and you've heard about it this week as well, they singled out China and Russia's military buildup and modernization program. Now, the Pentagon goes on to cite the deterioration of the U.S. nuclear triad of fixed-based ICBMs, bombers, and submarines. And they say, going forward, we have three objectives: rebuilding military readiness into a more lethal joint force, strengthening alliances and attracting new strategic partners, and reforming the Defense Department's business practice for affordability and performance. Now, what is significant here is that for two decades, the Pentagon's focus has been on the war on terror. That is now changing to great power confrontation and a whole new military strategy. The great wars of the past, you know, think of the Gulf War I and the Second Gulf War, where we had these massive amount of troops, tanks, and planes coming in almost like blitzkrieg. The Great War of the past were fought on ground with mass movement of troops, weapons, and planes. The wars of the future are going to be fought in space, cyberspace, with more advanced technological weapon systems. It's going to be a war that's most likely to be a push-button war.
For our listeners that really want to follow up on this and get into the nitty-gritty, Barron's just did a major piece on this regarding new Russian and Chinese missile systems that may spark a new arms race.
And what they're talking about here is a new word our listeners should get used to hearing more and more of, and that is called supersonics. The Chinese and the Russians are close to deploying them. I remember earlier in the spring, the Russians announcing it, and now the Chinese have. Now, if you take a look at what we use now in our military force, conventional missiles like, for example, the cruise missiles launched against Syria this year, travel at speeds of 550 miles an hour. supersonics travel at speeds of Mach 8 or 5 to 6 times the speed of sound. Imagine that. Moreover, they can travel at low undetectable levels, just like a cruise missile, and they can be maneuvered in flight at such speeds they are undetectable until minutes before they hit their intended target. This sharply reduces the decision-making time in the event of an attack. Now, if you look at the way the U.S. force structure looks today, it's aging, it's outdated, as well as expensive. For example, part of the nuclear triad, our ICBMs are stationary instead of being mobile and hard to detect like the Russians and the Chinese. We've reduced our submarine fleet as they've expanded theirs. And the U.S. main force structure is in what we call our carrier battle groups. And this is something that will really drive home this point, and this is out of Barron's. A typical carrier task force consists of 1 aircraft carrier, 2 destroyers, 2 guided missile cruisers, 1 frigate, 2 submarines, and 1 supply ship, 65 to 70 aircraft, and 7,500 personnel. That all comes at a cost of $20 billion to build and is very expensive to project. The U.S. Navy has 19 aircraft carriers, of which 10 can be considered aircraft carriers, meaning a big flight deck. You have smaller, what we call invasionary-type carriers that they use for the Marines in special forces that can have Harrier jets and helicopters. But this is what concerns the Pentagon. 1 $500,000 supersonic missile can neutralize an entire U.S. carrier battle group. So you're looking at cost structures, Chris, $500,000 versus $20 billion. And that's why Secretary Mattis talked about in their defense review. He says, we've got to get more efficient and we've got to get into a force structure that is more affordable. Obviously, a $500,000 missile against a $20 billion carrier battle group. And you can see the difference in terms of cost structures.
Well, that's exactly what we've seen technology do to the cost of everything, and which is to make it more advanced, but also less costly.
And that is exactly what Secretary Mattis is talking about. Much of the U.S. weapons systems arsenal are legacy weapons systems. In addition to spending, let's say, R&D on developing our own supersonics, which was in the new defense bill, we're going to spend $1.5 billion on supersonic research this year. We're also talking about AI, increasing our cyber warfare capabilities. In that regard, it is now reaching out, believe it or not. When you want to think about defense spending, you can't just think of defense contractors anymore. You got to think of big tech. The 5 largest tech companies spend more on research than the entire Defense Department. So the Defense Department has now put together a group, and they're reaching out to Silicon Valley. They're talking to folks like Amazon, which is big in the cloud, computing and AI, Microsoft and Alphabet. So if we look at, for example, the new Pentagon budget, it includes new nuclear subs, rebuilding the Navy from the current fleet of 280 ships, to 355 by 2030, an additional carrier battle group, hypersonic missiles, upgrading to mobile launch ICBMs, cyber warfare capabilities, bioengineering, kinetic weapons, AI, and autonomous vehicles. So basically what Mattis says, we've got a force structure that was designed for wars of the past. And what's that famous saying, generals are always fighting the last war? What Mattis is saying, that's not going to work. Those things don't work and can be taken out just like one missile can take out easily a carrier battle group. So we have to have a new weapon structure to be lethal and to deter.
You know, it's amazing, Jim, that other than the recent front cover of Barron's that I talked about, you really don't hear much of this talked about in the mainstream media. You know, especially with the midterms, I would have thought that one political side would have taken this and run with it right up to the midterms. But it appears that the United States, or at least the Defense Department and President Trump, that they're not taking this seriously.
The press may not be taking it seriously, but the Trump administration and the Defense Department is. In fact, last month, it went unnoticed amongst all the talk about midterm elections. But Vice President Pence gave a blistering talk taking aim at China over the stealing of U.S. technology. and then also taking a tough stance from trade to military actions. Just a few weeks ago, the last week in October, a pair of U.S. warships sailed through the Taiwan Straits in a show of support to a lot of our Asian allies. And really, what we were trying to do, the message to the Chinese is that the U.S. Navy can sail or fly and operate anywhere international law allows. Now, the public mission is also changed from passivity of recent years to building a lethal force that can win and project anywhere. And that's a strong message that they're trying to send out to Moscow and Beijing.
So it looks like, at least for the next few years, defense spending is going to be increasing by $160 billion. But you couldn't tell that by what happened to defense stocks recently. They've been in a downturn since last May. And that sell-off, by the way, was overdone. They're now bouncing back nicely. So, Jim, how do you play this if we're really entering a new Cold War?
You know, there's two ways to probably play this, with the obvious one being defense stocks. The other is big tech, as they are going to be playing a major role working with the Pentagon on both cyber warfare and AI. So there's two ways you can play with this. And once again, the kind of warfare that we're likely to see in the future is going to be in space, cyberspace, AI. You're just not going to see what we did in the first Gulf War or even the second Gulf War, where you amass a large array of troops, tanks on the battlefield. Because today, both Russia, China, and even Iran are working towards what they call battlefield nukes. One small little nuclear missile can wipe out your entire force structure on the ground. Same thing with the hypersonic missile to an aircraft carrier battle group. So it's going to be a different kind of warfare. It's going to be a high-tech warfare. And so there's two ways to play it: defense stocks and tech stocks.
Well, and I wonder if we'll hear more about this new change in military strategy or greater power conflicts going forward, other than what we're hearing about with the trade wars.
You know, I don't think this goes away. The real constraints for the U.S. will be its budget deficits. But here's the thing. You're going to hear a lot more and more about this. You haven't heard much recently. I was really surprised in January when I first saw this mentioned and when I read the defense a strategy for 2018, I thought, wow, this is a pretty big deal. You know, for two decades, we've been fighting the war on terror. Now it's great power confrontation. And that keeps getting emphasized. You see it, whether it's the president, vice president, or the secretary of defense or other members key in the administration. It comes out more and more. And even the Washington Post ran a editorial recently in the last couple of weeks talking about, boy, the clock is ticking. And we better get on it, because the advancements that are being made both by the Chinese and Russians, and not to mention others, are advancing at a rapid pace, and we could get far behind technologically.
Well, Jim, we've talked about some pretty weighty concerns, but what do you see for the weeks ahead?
Boy, Chris, we are going to have just lots of news going forward. Of course, probably the big thing hitting the markets is going to be the Fed meeting in December, when it's widely expected they'll be raising interest rates for the fourth time this year. You're seeing that reflected in treasuries right now, especially on the short end. You also have these stock buybacks, so we're going to watch those. Will that be enough to propel this market into the end of the year? And then, of course, shortly, we're going to begin the Christmas retail season. And right now, it's looking pretty strong. Retailers, believe it or not, are short, trying to find hired help for the Christmas season. They're short by almost 100,000 employees. And, of course, a combination of those things and then anything that may happen politically now that we have a divided Congress. You know, some new committee chairman coming out saying they're going to investigate or legislate. Now we have to watch politics a lot more closely, because I bet you're probably listening. You think, thank God the election's over. I hate to tell you, get ready for more, because we have now started silly season towards the Super Bowl, which is the 2020 presidential election, which began a day after the midterm election. So all of that coming up in the weeks and months ahead. Hope you'll be here to join us as we talk about these things as they unfold. In the meantime, on behalf of Chris Prytower and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.